This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Northern New England is not a place prone to hurricanes and tropical storms, though we had the Great One in 1938, Edna in 54, Gloria in 1985. The last storm of any real significance was Hurricane Bob in 1991. That's why last year all eyes were glued for a full week to the weather reports tracking the progress of Hurricane Irene as it barreled up the East Coast. The storm began in the Lesser Antilles, and by the time it got to the Bahamas, it was a Category 3 hurricane. But it reduced to a Category 1 by the time it reached North Carolina, and when it made landfall at southeastern New Jersey, it was downgraded to a tropical storm. But that didn't stop Irene from doing major damage. It crossed New York City and went inward into New Hampshire, Vermont, and upstate New York. And by the time it was finished, it became the fifth costliest hurricane on record, killing 16 people, destroying roads, homes, taking down a firehouse, and causing nearly every river and stream in Vermont to flood, as noted by one local weatherman that day.
I mean, this entire state is almost underwater. I mean, we have bridges that I've been across dozens of times in my life in Quincy, Vermont, that are just being washed away. I can't believe what I'm seeing right now out of my home state.
Repair costs in the Green Mountain State alone reached nearly $200 million, and now 1 year after the devastation of Hurricane Irene, some parts of northern New England have been permanently reshaped, while many others are still rebuilding and recovering. Today on The Exchange, we look back at Hurricane Irene, see how we've recovered and what we've learned, and we'd like to hear from you. Were you or was someone you know affected by last year's hurricane? What was the cost? How well did you bounce back? What have been the biggest challenges for you? And what have we as a region learned from Irene? Call in The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment or question on our Facebook page. We start the hour with Mary Stampone. She's assistant professor of geography at UNH and a state climatologist. She joins us by phone. Mary, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you for having me.
I mentioned a little bit of the history of hurricanes and big storms in New England. Could you tell us first how exactly Irene measures up?
Its path was a little bit different than, say, Bob, which had more of an impact on the seacoast area. But it took a similar path as some other hurricanes, such as the Great New England hurricane that occurred in 1938. And so it was fairly typical of what we would expect here in the fact that the major damage was due to inland flooding. Since we don't have much of a coastline here in New Hampshire, the coastal effects that most people associate with these types of tropical storms is not the big impact here. It's the flooding due to the very heavy rains that can occur pretty far inland in our area.
But we certainly did see plenty of rain and wind at the time, even if it didn't cause a lot of damage.
Yes, yes. Well, the rain did do substantial damage, whereas the wind was not as much of a factor.
I was on the air that morning covering the news during the storm, and I remember when Irene was downgraded to a tropical storm, and officials took pains to say, this is still very dangerous. Don't let up simply because of this downgrade. Could you explain that distinction between hurricane and tropical storm? And then could you also say what caused the storm to lose some of its power as it was moving into this region of the country?
Absolutely. They base the category on wind speed, but one of the things people don't really understand is the fact that even if the wind speeds are lower, it can still produce a lot of water. Some of the most damaging flooding that has occurred with tropical storms inland has been due to flooding with low category storms, such as a Category 1 or even tropical storms. And so despite the lower wind speeds, they can still cause a lot of damage simply because of the amount of water they produce and the amount of rainfall they produce. And so what we see with these storms as they approach our area, they've covered land, and the land tends to bring the storm's category down because the storms are really fed by warm ocean water. And so when they move over areas where they don't have the water and they don't have that heat source, they tend to weaken fairly quickly.
Did Irene take the path that you and others were expecting as it made its way in, or were there surprises?
No, actually, this was one of the storms where the forecasts were really, really dead on with where it was going to go. They pretty much knew that it was going to cross through central New England, you know, a few days out, and so the forecasts were really very accurate in terms of the path this storm it would take. They were a little uncertain in terms of how strong it would be, but they knew pretty much exactly where it was going to go several days out.
One more question for you, Mary. The perception now is that our weather systems seem less predictable, maybe more volatile, and the big storms are bigger than they used to be, for example, and more frequent, you know, than the old line about the once-in-a-century storm. Should New England consider itself, you know, needing to be ready for Irene-like storms more often going forward?
Yes, they should. In the patterns that we've noticed in looking back over the past 100 years or so, we see an increase in the more intense types of storms, and not necessarily tropical systems, but just, you know, general weather systems. And what we've noticed is that, you know, these storms are producing more rain over shorter time periods than we used to. And so it seems to be kind of the coming regime that we can expect more of these damaging, heavy, very intense rainfall events, whether they're tropical or not.
Mary, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Mary Stampone. She's assistant professor of geography at UNH and a state climatologist. Let's introduce our guests for the full hour. First in studio with me, Chris Pope. He's New Hampshire's director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Chris, nice to have you back on the exchange.
Thank you. Good morning.
And joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio, senior reporter and special projects producer Steve Zint. He's been covering the storm and its aftermath for VPR. Steve, welcome back to you as well.
Good morning, Brady.
Chris Pope, let's start with you. Mary Stampone said, you know, the storm did lose some power before it got to New Hampshire, but we sure saw plenty of damage. Where did we see the biggest effects in the Granite State?
Well, I think it's pretty clear our White Mountains region was sort of the ground zero for New Hampshire. I recall that as the storm was approaching and actually had penetrated New Hampshire, northern New England, I received a call on my cell phone from the chief warning meteorologist at Gray Maine National Weather Service. And he said, and we have a very close working relationship with the National Weather Service, as you might imagine. And he said, Chris, we're a couple of us here are looking at the radar. We're very concerned about the White Mountains. You know, it looks to us that they're going to be getting, you know, somewhere in the 8 to 13 inches of water falling out of the sky, which clearly in a New Hampshire situation means significant, substantial flash flooding. And, of course, you know, that's helpful information for us to have. We immediately reach out to our public safety folks in the White Mountains. And you think of all of the rivers draining out of the White Mountains. Every one of them had flooding issues.
Now, as you mentioned, this was a storm where we had some advance warning. Some storms come out of nowhere, like a tornado or that ice storm in late 2008. But what is the state's playbook, so to speak, when you know a storm like Irene is coming? And how well did it wind up working out?
Well, the playbook for us is a very detailed multi-page checklist that's broken down into categories and broken down into time segments. So, for example, we're looking at Isaac right now, and we have a checklist that begins 72 hours out prior to anticipated landfall. Obviously, Isaac's a lot farther away than that. But as Irene was working its way up the coast, it's critical for us to establish this impact timeline because we need to checklist certain things 72 hours out, 48 hours out, 24 hours out, and essentially we need to have everything nailed down, ready to go 6 hours before the landfall of significant wind or rain. So we followed that with every event, and as you know, we've had a number of events in this state in the past 6 to 8 years. We changed that checklist depending on lessons that we learn.
Steve's in. New Hampshire saw plenty of the storm. Vermont really saw the worst of it. And you and VPR have been covering the aftermath of the storm, especially this week. But to start, Vermont's public radio's power itself was out as the storm hit. Some of the state agencies that would have been dealing with the storm were themselves out of commission for a while. So how did Vermont even start to take stock of the storm and the damage in that situation?
Yeah, Brady, you mentioned the state agencies and the difficulty they have. Vermont has about 1,300 to 1,500 state employees, or had that many, working at a large state office complex in Waterbury, which happens to be where Vermont Emergency Management was located and where the Agency of Natural Resources, which manages rivers, is located. The Winooski River runs right by that complex, and it flooded the complex. It didn't really damage the buildings, but it basically flooded their cellars. Power was out. Servers were threatened. And at one point, Vermont Emergency Management had to pick up and move its operations to Burlington. And especially for the Agency of Natural Resources, which was trying to get a handle on what was going on with the rivers and where people needed to go and communicate with the individual towns. So many towns were affected by the flood. It was a huge problem in the initial stages of the storm. That said, I think the state gets a lot of credit, not only in terms of the emergency management folks, but especially the folks at the Vermont Agency of Transportation for their response to the storm.
So the feeling among Vermonters is not, boy, the state dropped the ball on this one, but the state did its best under very difficult circumstances.
I think that's the case. I think everybody was surprised and heartened by how quickly roads were opened and emergency vehicles and help was able to get through to those communities. And there were about 13 communities that were totally isolated by the storm. There was no way in or out. And that, you know, lasted for 3 or 4 days. But there were countless neighborhoods, back roads neighborhoods, where dirt roads were washed out, where you had, you know, half a dozen houses or more, you know, groups of people who were isolated. And, you know, months later, when there was the storm that hit southern New England and folks were without power for seemingly weeks in that region, I think a lot of Vermonters took heart in the fact that power was restored within days to most of the state, and that the state responded very well in the initial stages of the storm. The long-term recovery has been another story.
And you mentioned a number of towns that were literally cut off from the rest of the state. In a way, you could see being a typical New England small town where people know each other and kind of pitch in together might have been handy in a crisis.
It really did work out that way. I can think of some examples. There's a little town of Pittsfield. It has no school. It has no barber shop. It has no medical facilities. And yet, when all of its occupants found themselves isolated, they discovered they had teachers. They had medical people who lived in the school. They had a barber. So they set up a barber shop, an outdoor school, and a clinic. And people were able to have their needs met.
We'll talk more about that after a short break. This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. NHPR is your source for election coverage throughout the coming months. Tune in next week as we bring you live coverage of the Republican National Convention from Tampa, Florida. We'll have speeches, interviews with delegates, and analysis from NPR's team of experts. Coverage starts Monday night at 8 on NHPR. More on Hurricane Irene 1 year later on The Exchange on NHPR, then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. It's the Friday News Roundup. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Antioch University New England, offering master's and teacher certification programs for working teachers, future teachers, and aspiring Waldorf teachers. AntiochNE.edu. And the Scott Lawson Companies, protecting your company's most valuable asset, your people, through workers' comp, wellness, and health and safety services. HealthierWorkers.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson in for Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, 1 year after Hurricane Irene. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. We're with Steve Zinn. He's senior reporter and special projects producer for Vermont Public Radio, which has been producing a series of stories about the year after Hurricane Irene. We're also joined by Chris Pope, director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in New Hampshire. Chris, just before the break, Steve was talking about some of these towns that were cut off, and you and I were just talking during the break about the memories that starts bringing up for you as you think about what was happening here in New Hampshire, especially in the Conway area, some of the stories that were coming out of that part of the state.
Well, that's right. And clearly Vermont, you know, was hit harder than New Hampshire. That said, for anybody that had damage, it was a tough storm to deal with. I spoke with some folks who had been rescued by firefighters up in Conway, and their story was just truly frightening. They lived in an area that was flood-prone. They knew it, but they had never seen the Saco River come up as high as it did that night. They found themselves literally standing on the peak of their roof with, you know, few inches left before the building went completely underwater. Looked up in the dark, saw the fire department boat come around a clump of tops of trees in the current. This is, for a firefighter, probably the worst case scenario of a rescue operation, fraught with danger. And this woman said, you know, that before I knew it, the boat was right up against the tip of our roof. They pulled me into the boat. The boat immediately went up against a pile of brush. For those who are experienced with swift water rescue, they know that's frequently the end, and that's when tragedy occurs. Firefighters were able to get this boat aimed upstream, and she said they were starting to move away from this brush, and she looked up, and here came a 30-foot camper floating down right at them in the dark, you know, and they were able to miss that. So you heard stories like this from the people that were being rescued, and it's, you know, we were fortunate. We only lost one citizen here in New Hampshire. There were several dozens that had injuries, most of them minor, but the life safety piece of it is significant.
Steve, so much damage and lives lost. And Chris's story about the camper floating by reminds me of some of the videos that were everywhere on YouTube and on social media in the aftermath of the storm, of the covered bridges just washing out these structures that had been up for centuries and so, you know, so central to the character of some of these small towns in Vermont, just gone.
Yes, and that was one of the most striking parts about the storm, as those of us who experienced it walked out the day after, was how the infrastructure had changed and also how the landscape had changed, how where there had been farm fields were suddenly holes with rocks that were now part of a riverbed. I think that kind of destruction was beyond our imagination before Irene.
I wanted to ask both of you, and I'll start with you, Steve. What about the fact that these two states are so rural, that we have small towns that are not necessarily right abutting next to their neighbor town? Some of the roads are small town roads. We have plenty of trees, lakes, rivers. How much would that play into it? And would the damage have been as severe if we were, say, more urban?
I think, you know, Vermont's geography and the way settlement has occurred in Vermont is something that certainly exacerbated the problem, so to speak, because our settlement patterns are in the valleys. Our fertile farmland is along the rivers. That's just the way it is, and that is not going to change. And it's that kind of geography that I think sort of amplified the damage that Irene caused. And then, of course, in the wake of the storm, what you're alluding to, Brady, the isolation of communities, the fact that their access was only through roads that went down those valleys, made the immediate response all the more challenging.
Chris, I'll ask the same question to you. That rural character of New Hampshire that we're so proud of, maybe playing a role in the aftermath of the storm.
Well, I think Steve is absolutely right, and I don't think it's just Vermont and New Hampshire, but traditionally, if you look at our populations in this country, they're right up on the coastline and they're right along rivers. Rivers, especially in the Northeast, were primary means of commerce and business and farming, and so that's why we're there. A lot of communities have established strict code enforcement to prevent growth in flood-prone areas. Some have not. In New Hampshire, you know, we had 53, I mean, kudos to our Department of Transportation and all of the local road agents out there, because this is not easy stuff to fix. You damage a bridge, you take out a state highway, it's a complicated fix. And by the way, you know, there needs to be a quick temporary fix. In New Hampshire, we had 53 state highway segments completely taken out, and we had 213 local roads that were heavily damaged. And I have to, you know, remember too, for New Hampshire and Vermont, this is weeks before the fall foliage season, which is a huge economic engine for both Vermont and New Hampshire.
At the same time, we're expecting boatloads and busloads of tourists to come in, and there's no way for them to get up to see the foliage.
In both New Hampshire and Vermont. In New Hampshire, Route 16 was closed. The Kankamongas Highway was closed. Other major North Country east-west and north-south routes were closed. And in a this was a big deal. I remember fondly, we have a situation room in our State Emergency Operations Center where the governor and key department heads meet, and work on these major incidents. And I recall the governor asking, when is the Kankamongas going to be open? And, an engineer correctly said, that it would be correctly at the time said, Governor, it's going to take us 3 months to get that road open. That was not the answer the governor wanted to hear. and I will tell you, I'm not going to tell secrets out of our situation room, but the governor essentially said, I want that road open in 2 weeks. And DOT stepped up to the plate, and in an emergency situation, they were able to develop contracts very quickly, and they had the Kank open in that 2 weeks. In fact, the governor and a bunch of us went on a bus tour of the whole length of it just with a bunch of news media folks. And that was a big deal for the North Country. From a business perspective, from a getting back on their feet.
Let's take a call from one of our listeners. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. This is Tom calling from Norwich, Vermont. Hi, Tom. You're on the exchange.
Hi. Thank you. My question has to do with the role of radio during an event like Irene. One of the things I noticed while it was actually happening was there was very little live information available, even from the public radio station, about road closings and, power outages and things like that. How can that be improved?
It's a great question, Tom. Let me throw that one at you, Steve.
Yeah, I think it was a learning experience for everyone, and I can certainly say it was a learning experience for Vermont Public Radio. I can't speak for all the radio stations in Vermont, and for the Department of Transportation to sort of figure out how to mobilize resources and communicate with people as quickly as possible and to keep that information up to date. That was a real challenge, too, because once the information was put out there, once a method was arrived at to get it out there, then it became quickly out of date as roads were opened or new roads were discovered that were closed. So I like to think that both radio and state officials have learned some lessons from that experience that would enable us to respond better and differently to future disasters.
And Chris Pope, in a lot of ways, that's the idea behind your job, is the Homeland Security and Emergency Management, to centralize that coordinated planning.
Sure. And Tom's question's a great one. Of course, you recall we had an ice storm here in 2008. Two-thirds of the state was without power, many people without power for 2 weeks. And we did a lot of sought a lot of public input as an after-action process from the ice storm. And I remember a woman in Exeter saying, Mr. Pope, I think you all did a great job during the ice storm of communicating with everybody in the state that had power, and I think you did a lousy job of communicating to people that didn't have power. And she was right. And I said, ma'am, you're absolutely correct. And so we've taken a number of steps here to turn that around. First of all, radio stations aren't staffed 24/7 anymore like they used to be in the old days. So we've now got cell phone numbers, home phone numbers with key radio station engineers and folks that can get a station up. We've worked out a relationship where we can do more of those live updates. Where are the shelters? Where are they open? Where can I get potable water? That type of thing, the type of things that I think Tom's probably referring to. And also today is social media. The amount of communicating that occurs via social media, and frankly, especially in 2008, we weren't where we needed to be. I don't feel that we are today where we need to be, but we are working on it. Because you know what? If you have a battery-operated radio or you have a cell phone and you have a cell phone charger that can plug into your dashboard of your pickup truck or your car, and you can run your car, you can charge that thing up and stay connected. It's up to us to and in working with public radio, working with other commercial radio outlets to continue to build that relationship. That's a great point by Tom.
That role of social media is a good one to stress, too, Brady, as Chris is saying. You know, one thing that happened in the wake of Irene was a young woman from Burlington, a University of Vermont student, I think, took it on herself to drop everything and set up a website to help coordinate the volunteer activities. And while people who lived right in the hardest hit areas may not have had internet access, there were many, many other Vermonters who were unaffected by the storm who really wanted to help out in some way. And that website was really critical in giving information to those people about where they could go, what they could take, and how they could help.
Tom, great question. Thanks so much for joining us. The number is on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. One of the areas hardest hit in the state, as we mentioned, was the White Mountain National Forest. And joining us now by phone is Tom Wagner. He's Forest Supervisor at the White Mountain National Forest. Tom, thanks so much for being with us today.
Hello, Brady.
A year ago, what struck you when you first started to see the damage that Irene had caused in the forest?
Well, I mean, just like everybody, the scale of the water and the flash flooding that resulted from that, we had prepared for some flooding and blowdown, but we probably underestimated the amount of water and the damage potential on the forest.
And do we know now, a year later, just how much damage there was?
Yeah, we project that we've probably got a little over $12 to $13 million worth of damage. We're working hard. We began working hard with many of our partner agencies at the state and local level, and trail clubs, and Trout Unlimited, and Student Conservation Association. Lots of folks have been working on repairing some of the damage. We've got over 20 road and bridge projects that are actively being worked on by private contractors. But still quite a bit of work to do just based on places where there's been significant changes in trail systems that we need to do some further assessment before we decide how those systems will be put back in place.
And I was going to ask, because some damage is repairable and other damage permanently changes the landscape. So you're still figuring out exactly which is which in some cases.
That's correct. And, of course, I've been involved in emergency management for 30 years, and you always learn things. You never have it all figured out. So we are really working on making sure that our facilities can accommodate these extreme weather events to as best as possible with the resources we have.
That was my other question about resources, because there has been some federal money available for the repair projects. Do you think it's going to be enough to repair or at least ameliorate all of the damage that's been caused in the forest?
Well, certainly in our current economic conditions, there won't be all the federal funds that we need. We've received money from the Federal Highway Administration. We've gotten Forest Service funds, and then a lot of work being done by our volunteers and trail adopters and people like that. We also have here in a couple weeks at Waterville Valley, we'll be launching a National Forest Treasured Landscape effort. This is a group that is congressionally authorized by Congress as a nonprofit to raise private funds to work on restoration projects like this. So they're going to attempt to raise $1 million of private funds that will be matched by $1 million of Forest Service funds. And that'll be launched on October 3rd up in Waterville Valley.
Now, I know that this is not the first time that the forest has seen trail damage. There was damage during the hurricane of 1938, but this time around there was more damage because there was more infrastructure, more trails, more buildings, more for a storm to damage. So going forward, does the experience of Irene change your plans for trails or infrastructure in the forest, or at least how you may design those trails or that infrastructure?
Yeah, certainly we are looking for opportunity. You know, many of our trails were put in over 100 years ago, and they went straight up ridges and across streams with little thought of these kind of events. And so anywhere we can avoid stream crossings, anyway, where when we have to have a bridge, it's designed to accommodate large storm events like this, we are certainly looking at. And there are probably some areas, just based on what has happened, that it will not be possible to put the trail back in that location.
Tom, great to talk with you. Thanks so much for taking the time.
You bet. Thank you.
Tom Wagner is forest supervisor for the White Mountain National Forest, one of the areas most hard hit by Tropical Storm Irene in New Hampshire. Today in the exchange, we're talking about Hurricane Irene 1 year later. In late August of 2011, New England prepared as the storm barreled up the East Coast. To the surprise of many, Vermont was the hardest hit, with roads, bridges, and farmland badly damaged. Let's hear from you now. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. What do you remember about Tropical Storm Irene in New Hampshire and Vermont? What do you think we've learned as a region in the year that's followed? 1-800-892-6477. Chris Pope, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. This issue that Tom Wagner brought up about funding. We're in an age where budgets are at a premium, state, federal, both trying to keep costs down as the economy tries to recover, but does so slowly at best. How much of a factor is that? Are you worried that you'll have the resources that you need for the next big hurricane or, say, blizzard?
Well, I think there's multiple answers to that question. First, I just want to say Tom Wagner is truly a very understated and modest guy. He did a great job managing issues during Irene and the White Mounds. He was down in our Situation Room with the senior leadership team, and what a great leader he is for our national forest. You know, the money piece from, you know, if you look at it from a response perspective, we don't sit there and look in our wallet and go, what can we afford to do in terms of saving lives and property during an incident? It's not the appropriate way to manage. We don't do that. The governor doesn't believe in that, and that's good. That's the public safety mantra that we need to have. The question becomes is during recovery, which Vermont is still recovering, many families and communities are still recovering in New Hampshire, to what extent can they be reimbursed for expenses to public infrastructure, individuals, homes, and businesses? Typically, if we get a federal presidential declaration, which we did for Irene, the federal government will pay 75% of eligible expenses that local communities incurred, including damages to roads and bridges, or if a fire station roof was damaged, that type of thing. But the news is not as good, frankly, in my opinion, for businesses. They may qualify through the SBA for low-interest loans, but it may not be the low-interest loan that's going to help the business that may have lost, you know, 2 weeks of business income at a time when it was critical for that business. Think back to, again, fall foliage season, and think back to the ice storm 2 weeks before Christmas in 2008.
Those are times you don't get back. And I want to pick up with that after a short break with Steve Zinn of Vermont Public Radio to see if that conversation has played out any differently in the Green Mountain State. We'd also like to hear from more of you. The exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. We'll have more of our conversation about the year that's passed since Hurricane Irene coming up on the exchange after a short break.
Has that old car or truck been sitting in the driveway too long? Maybe you're balking at the hassle of selling it and not sure where to start. That's what NHPR's vehicle donation program is for. We make it easy. Give us a call to get the process started. We'll arrange to pick up the vehicle, put together the paperwork, and relieve you of the stress of dealing with that old car. The number to call is 1-877-393-NHPR or visit nhpr.org.
This is NHPR, where support comes from UR members and the Community College System of New Hampshire, now enrolling students for the fall semester at college locations statewide. Information at ccsnh.edu. And Golf and Ski Warehouse, with stores in Hudson, Greenland, and West Lebanon, New Hampshire, and also in Scarborough, Maine, online at golfandskiwarehouse.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy. Monday on The Exchange, we replay our talk with historian and author Robert Perot on the rich history of Franco-Americans in the Granite State. That's coming up Monday morning on The Exchange at 9 o'clock. Today, we're talking about Hurricane Irene 1 year later. In late August of 2011, New England prepared as the storm barreled up the East Coast, and Vermont ended up the hardest hit state in the region, with roads, bridges, and farmland badly damaged and lives lost. Parts of New Hampshire were hit hard as well. We're talking about what we've learned from the storm and how we've recovered in this past year. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. We've been talking with Chris Pope, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in New Hampshire, and Steve Zinn, Senior Reporter and Special Projects Producer for Vermont Public Radio. And just before the break, Steve, we were talking about the issue of resources, the budget in New Hampshire, and I wonder how that conversation has played out in Vermont. I understand that Vermont has been in something of a dispute with the Federal Emergency Management Agency over some of the costs of repairs and things like that.
Yeah, I mentioned earlier in the program, Brady, that the state office complex in Waterbury had been flooded. That's also the site of the Vermont State Hospital, which it's been decided by the governor will now be closed and will be rebuilt at another location, another facility. And there's a huge dispute going on right now about how much of that work to both the state hospital and the state office complex FEMA is going to pay for. State officials say they were misled earlier and believe that FEMA would pay for more than it's now indicated it would pay for. But that's that amount is still to be decided, and we probably won't know for a few weeks. You know, Chris made a great point about businesses. There was a great outpouring of support for farmers. Fish held a benefit concert that raised a lot of money for farmers. Funds were established. And while there is still quite a bit of unmet need among farmers, the businesses really didn't have the resources that individuals and that towns and that even farmers had, except for those loans. And many businesses couldn't take on the added debt. And you know, a state official told me the other day that generally nationwide, 25% to 40% of businesses that go through disasters like Irene ultimately fail after a few years. The state says it's trying to bend that curve by freeing up more money. It's still loan money, but at no interest or no payments for the first year, payments only on interest for the second year, and at low interest rates to try to help buoy those businesses that are maybe open but still haven't recovered from the flood.
Among the many forms of damage that we saw during Irene was power outages for thousands, hundreds of thousands of people in both states. And for more on that, we turn to Martin Murray, spokesman for Public Service of New Hampshire. Martin, welcome back to The Exchange.
Thanks, Brady.
We've seen some large-scale power outages, as we've mentioned several times over the last few years. How did Irene compare in terms of outages?
It was, at the time, our third worst storm. We've had a more significant one since then, last October, so it's now ranks as the fourth worst. And they've all come since 2008, so that kind of ties in, I think, with what Mary was talking about at the top of the hour. But it was a very significant storm. We had, at its peak, about 125,000 PSNH homes and businesses without power. And it took about 3 days to get 99% of those customers back.
Now, I remember in the ice storm of 2008, sort of the big outage that kind of kicked off that series of events, you mm-hmm. had out-of-state crews who were able to come in and assist your own staff to get power up and running again. But given that this storm stretched out across so much of the eastern seaboard, how much were you able to rely on outside crews? Were they working in their own states?
Yeah, getting outside help is terrific, and it's necessary. But when an event is regional in nature, like this storm was, that help sometimes is not timely, and it's certainly not guaranteed. And that's something that is deeply concerning. There are other crews, but they'll be further away, and it takes longer for them to get there. For example, if we had a similar event now, and it was impacting the entire East Coast, we and others would have to look to the Midwest. So help would be available. It might take a little bit longer to get there. But we're all aware of that, and there is deep respect, and there is a mutual aid system set up. So we would not do anything that was untoward or unfair in hurting customers of other utilities, but we'd certainly be trying to do everything we could fairly to get the help that we would need to get our customers back online.
What do you think power companies have learned during this stretch of large outages about dealing with the aftermath of a big storm? Obviously, you can't prevent the outage, but can you handle infrastructure differently, crews differently, the operations of restoration differently?
Well, Brady, we found that the restoration works. We have highly skilled crews, and we can get the system back up and running. What's changed, really, I think, is the expectations of society. You know, with the communication devices, for example, that you've talked about a little bit, there, and how we use electricity today, there really is this expectation that it will always be there. And boy, when it's not, we all feel that. So there's a real expectation of demand for incredible reliability. And when it's down, we need to back up. So the key then is, even when the power's out, communication. You know, I heard the anecdote that Chris described regarding communicating with those who don't have power. That's very key. And what we've done working with the state and with the local municipalities is to work to have one community liaison from PSNH assigned to every single town. And the theory is, and it works, if we have a single point of contact with that town and we impart important and up-to-date information about what's happening and what they can expect, that word will filter down to those residents in town without power. It may take a while. It might be phone trees. It might be just people walking into the town hall and asking, but that word will get out. So that we've really worked hard to improve our database and to speed up the process of getting those liaisons hooked in with that single point of contact in each town.
That expectation for information stretches, and we mentioned this earlier as well, to social media. And you and I were among those who were on Twitter during the storm sharing information. The hashtag people were using in this state was NHIrene, and I think in Vermont it was VTIrene. Obviously, not everyone could access that information, but those who could were sharing it with each other online and then spreading the information through those other channels.
Correct. And our Twitter followers are well over 10,000 now. And just as a result of Storm Irene, we calculated that our Twitter followers increased 40% during that event. And as you know, Brady, and I think many of your listeners do, it's not always necessary for one to be, you know, quote, following Twitter. But if New Hampshire Public Radio follows us on Twitter, it can then reach out to, you know, tens of thousands of its listeners by broadcasting that information. So our ability now to, in real time, provide information from remote locations right into your smartphone and for you then to pass it on to your listeners is just that it's a godsend. It really is.
Martin Murray, thanks as always for taking the time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That's Martin Murray, spokesman for Public Service of New Hampshire. Today on The Exchange, Hurricane Irene, 1 year later. We'd like to hear from you at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guests in studio, Chris Pope, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management for the state of New Hampshire, and joining us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio, Steve Zinn, Senior Reporter and Special Projects Producer for VPR. Steve, you've been reporting on a number of people who are still trying to negotiate with insurance companies or with FEMA. You talked about the state of Vermont trying to negotiate with FEMA in a dispute. A year is a long time. We talked about some of that lost business that, and you're seeing residents who, you know, maybe still are without water sources or the damage has not been repaired in their houses. Is this process simply too slow?
Well, the long-term recovery, folks, will tell you that's why we call it long-term recovery. I think, you know, Vermonters are new to something like this, and I think there perhaps was an expectation, whether it was realistic or not, that in some cases we might be further along than we are in terms of helping individuals recover. And according to the long-term recovery group, we still have 700 families and individuals who need some kind of help with Irene recovery. We've got some people who are just coming forward now after a year, which is hard to believe, but people who, you know, thought they could make it or thought other people needed help more than they did or were just stubborn about accepting help who are coming forward and with still some serious problems like not having drinking water or functioning septic systems as a result of Irene. The long-term recovery people told me there's a slow but steady pace of new cases developing as a result of that. So I think that's sort of puzzling in some respect, but it's probably not unusual when you look at other disaster recoveries. They say it takes 2 to 4 years to really get through most of this recovery process, and people just need to adjust to that.
Chris Pope, have you seen some of those new cases in the course of this year? And if so, has that changed the way that you've been handling the aftermath of Irene?
Well, we saw it, I first saw it back in 2007. We had a bad nor'easter come up and hit us pretty hard and received a federal declaration, had a lot of families impacted by that storm. And I came on board, this was 2006, Mother's Day flood. And when I came on board, this was probably 4 or 5 months later, we did not have at that time we didn't feel comfortable that we had a good accounting for everybody that was impacted. So we actually assembled teams and went out in communities that we knew were impacted and did a boots on the ground, door-to-door check of people. And we did find that there were people very resilient, New Englanders that were in their homes, that maybe their furnace wasn't working and here come winter's coming. They had mold in their basement. An electrical entrance had been damaged. You name it. In one case, someone literally needed to be transported to the hospital because they were feeling the effects of the, damage to their home. So this is not, this requires a team effort. It requires local public safety officials working with state officials, working with the private sector, working with groups like the community action programs, the Red Cross, the nonprofits, to work together various church-affiliated volunteer groups to work together to really look for these people, and particularly those that are most vulnerable, particularly those that may have functional needs. And we encountered, in the ice storm, again during Irene, a lot of our elder residents in the state, they did not want to leave their homes. They were without power, but you know what? I'm good. I've been here 30, 40, 50, 60 years. I'm staying. And that's a particular challenge for local public safety folks because you have to dedicate resources to go check on those folks every day and make sure they're okay. So, we did not see that as much here. We do have families. We have less than 20 now that we have right on our radar screen that we're paying attention to. It is something that is a challenge. And it's such a horrible thing to have your life impacted by a disaster like this that it is tough to get back on your feet.
Let's take another call from one of our listeners. This is Donald. He's calling from Atkinson. Hi, Donald. You're on the Exchange.
Yes, I'd like to ask how the funding's doing for the U.S. Geological Survey Stream Gauge Network. Most of those gauges were put back in during the Depression. A few have been added, but it seems to be just a constant battle to keep the ones we have. And the current network is not designed to detect the kind of flash flooding we had in Vermont or even back in 2005 in New Hampshire when we had a storm out in the western part, where the water level came up very quickly. And the data doesn't seem to be used to warn people to get their cars, and things they can move out of the way before they get washed down the river.
That's a great question, Donald. Chris?
Great question. I wish I had a quick answer suitable for a short radio show. But that is a great question, Donald. Couple things. You're right that the federal funding is a huge challenge. We recently saw a river gauge disappear here in New Hampshire. I will tell you those river gauges are critical public safety instruments. Local public safety and emergency management officials use those gauges. You can view them online. If you go to a search engine and type in NWS for National Weather Service, Northeast River Forecast Center, you can go to these gauges and you can actually see them predict where your river level is going. Well, that's great, but you may not know what 12 feet on your particular river in your hometown means versus 16 feet. Studies are critical. Research is being done in some of these river basins, such as the Suncook, the Sauhegan, and some others in New Hampshire that designed to provide local public safety people information on how much will a certain amount of rain cause their river to rise in their community, and how will that impact people that live in structures and decisions about evacuation or all of that. So there is a lot of work being done there. These are critical devices, and we hope that the federal government continues to invest in them.
Donald, thanks so much for that call. And one last question for each of you. A year from now, as we mark 2 years since Irene, what would you like to see in the recovery process that maybe we haven't seen yet? And I'll start with you, Chris.
Well, I think there's a couple of things. I mean, I could spend just an hour on that, Brady. I mean, there's 100 things I'd like to see. One of the things that we're investing time in right now, have been since Irene, is building better working relationships with the private sector. Martin Murray's on with PSNH. You know, we've spent a lot of time working with PSNH and the co-op and what is now Liberty and Unitil to build that communication. We've also, but it's not just about power, you know, and people in New Hampshire do have to understand that they are going to lose power occasionally due to these more frequent storms. But it's also about gasoline and potable water and the ability for people to get prescription drugs. So we're building a relationship now with the Grocers Association, encourage them. They're establishing an emergency operations center for their own constituents. We're building communications with them. It's been a remarkable relationship that we've built there, and looking forward to that serving us in our next disaster.
And Steve Zinn, briefly, what would you like to see a year from now in Vermont?
I think the word that's creeping into everyone's language now is resiliency, and that has to do with how do we not only recover from the flood, but protect ourselves to the extent that we can from future floods? How do we protect mobile home parks, which are in flood-prone areas, from being struck as hard as they did? How do we protect communities and businesses and basically build things better and make communities more resilient? Those questions are just being asked now, and hopefully we'll see some answers a year from now.
Well, thanks to both of you for joining us today.
Thank you.
Chris Pope is New Hampshire's Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. Steve Zinn, a senior reporter and special projects producer for Vermont Public Radio. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern is Samantha Johnson. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Brady Carlson, in for Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
Every weekday at 9 a.m., The Exchange examines the issues that concern you. The ones you talk about around the water cooler or at the breakfast table. Our focus is the news of the day, be it politics, education, or the environment. We bring you conversations about events half a world away or just down the street. I'm Laura Kanoy. Join me for The Exchange, weekday mornings at 9 on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show and the Friday News Roundup next at 10 on NHPR.